The Horror of Abbot's Grange by Frederick Cowles. It was Joan who fell in love with Abbot's Grange. I must confess that from the first I thought the place had a brooding and sinister air about it. For 3 months we had been house hunting, and then a chance visit to Ritten had led to the discovery of the Grange. As far as country houses go, it was perfect. It had been erected in the 15th century by the Cistercian monks of Ritten Abbey, and a tiny detached chapel was a relic of the monastic days. Yet in spite of the fact that Joan was mad about it, I did not like the place. The next day we sought out the estate agent, and he willingly agreed to conduct us over the house. It turned out to be the property of Lord Sultan, and it was his desire to let the place furnished. That suited us, as being birds of passage, we had no furniture of our own. It was not a large house, but the rooms were spacious. The entrance hall was really quite palatial, and hung with paintings of the dead and gone sultans. I examined the portraits while the agent was revealing the charms of the Grange to Joan. They were not a very imposing lot, those sultans of the past. One was a bishop, looking very uncomfortable in his robes. Another, a general, mounted on a weird-looking charger. Not one of them really interested me, until I came upon a dingy painting hung in a dark corner near the stairs. It represented a tall, sallow-featured man, dressed in sombre garments of early 16th century style. His face was thin and brooding, and strangely pale, but the lips were intensely red, and were drawn back to show white, fang-like teeth. The whole expression was one of diabolical cruelty, and I shuddered involuntarily as I looked at it. An inscription in the right-hand corner of the painting caught my eye. The writing was rather faded, but I was just able to make out the words, William Sultan, painted 1572, and below, in rather brighter colours, was a small cross, and the sentence, "Seeking whom he may devour, God frustrate him always." Joan and the agent returned just then, and I called their attention to the portrait. It may have been my imagination, but I thought a shade of fear passed over the man's face. I asked him who the sinister gentleman was, and, with some slight show of reluctance, he answered, "That is a picture of the first Lord Sultan. He is said to have been a monk at Ritten Abbey, but they turned him out. At the dissolution, he revenged himself upon the community by giving evidence against them. Many of the monks were executed, and as a reward, William Sultan was made Lord Sultan, and this house was given to him." "How exciting!" exclaimed Joan. "He looks just the sort of person to do a thing like that. We really must have this house, Michael. It is just what we have been looking for." When Joan makes up her mind, there is no gainsaying her. Within an hour, I had paid a deposit, signed the lease, and received the keys of Abbot's Grange. As he handed the keys over to me, the agent pointed out an exceptionally large one, and said, "This, sir, is the key of the chapel. It has been closed for nearly 300 years, and Lord Sultan particularly requests that you will not enter the place. If you should feel you want to visit it, go in the daytime, and be sure to lock the door when you leave. On no account allow the door to be unlocked between dusk and daybreak." "But," I exclaimed, "that is a curious condition. What is the reason for it?" The agent's face was blank as he answered, "I do not know, sir. Those are Lord Sultan's instructions to me." With that I had to be content, although I felt that the man could have told more if he had cared to. 3 weeks later, with a staff engaged by Joan and my sister, we took up residence at Abbot's Grange. Of course, Joan had to have a housewarming party, By making up extra beds on sofas and floors, we managed to invite about 20 people down. Then there were a few local residents, such as the vicar and the doctor, who were asked to dinner. Before the meal, I was standing in front of the fire in the hall. The others were all dressing, and there was only a dim light burning on the staircase. I was thinking how impressive the place looked when, quite suddenly, somebody switched on all the lights. It was the butler, taking some glasses to the dining room. "Good Lord, man!" I shouted. "Why on earth did you switch all those lights on like that?" He looked rather confused, and then he blurted out,
I always do that, sir. None of us will come into the hall after dark unless the lights are full on."
"What on earth is there to be frightened of here?" I stormed. "You must be like a lot of children afraid of the dark."
The man's voice was apologetic as he replied,
"It isn't that, sir. It's that painting under the stairs. His eyes seem to follow you about."
I glanced over at the portrait of the first Lord Sultan, and whether it was a trick of the artist or a trick of the light, the eyes certainly did seem to glare out of the canvas. They almost seemed to be illuminated by an uncanny glow. The butler stood expecting a further reprimand when the vicar was announced. The clergyman turned out to be quite an affable little man, the usual type of country parson, but endowed with more brains than most. We discussed the weather, the political situation, and a few other minor things. Then I asked him if he knew anything about the first Lord Sultan.
"Quite enough to make me detest him," he replied. "He was a hateful type, a man who became a Cistercian monk, and then gave information against the abbot and brethren."
"Wasn't he turned out of the abbey long before the suppression?" I inquired.
"Yes, he was accused of practicing black magic, and they expelled him from the order. I think the details are given in a manuscript that used to be in the library. If you like, we will look and see if it is still there."
I readily agreed, and we were just moving off when the gong went, and the guests began to come down for dinner, so we had to postpone our visit to the library. The meal was quite a jolly function. As usual, Joan had managed to assemble quite a distinguished and interesting company. There was Vincent Dunn, the actor, Rita Young, the film star, Edmund Morton, the novelist, Malcolm Dale, the explorer, and a host of other celebrities of one sort or another. And they were all quite human, which says a lot for Joan's taste. It was Morton who asked about the chapel, and I had to tell them all about the conditions relating to it.
"And have you been inside yet?" asked Dale.
"Not I," I replied. "I put the key in the Chinese vase in the hall, and there it stays until my lease is up." They all seemed to think it very jolly to have a private chapel, and the possibility of its being haunted was freely discussed. Well, then the talk drifted round to plays and films, and the chapel was forgotten. At least, I thought it was. There was dancing in the hall afterwards, and as soon as we could reasonably do so, the vicar and I slipped off to the library. He found the book without any trouble. It was a musty, calf-bound volume filled with crabbed handwriting. It seemed to be a catalogue of the pictures in the hall, with some biographical notes, and the first person mentioned was William Sultan. The following is the extract relating to him. "William Sultan, born 1501, entered the Abbey of Our Lady of Ritten, 1522. Accused of practicing witchcraft, sorcery, and black magic, and expelled from the monastery in 1530. In 1539 gave evidence before the commissioners against the abbot and community, which resulted in the abbot and six of the brethren being condemned to death. Evidence afterwards proved to be false, but Sultan was made Lord Sultan, and received the Abbey Grange, lived the life of a recluse, and commonly believed to have been a wizard and a vampire. Died in 1597, and buried in the private chapel of Abbot's Grange. No priest would perform the burial rites, and he was interred without prayer or ceremony." Then, in another hand, followed a later entry.
On the 16th day of May, 1640, the tomb of William Lord Sultan was sealed by me, John Rogers, clerk in holy orders. Let none loose the chapel door between sunset and sunrise, lest perchance he come abroad again, seeking whom he may devour. God frustrate him always. What does that mean? I asked. Well, answered the parson, I should say that the First Lord Sultan could not rest in his grave, and John Rogers was called in to lay his unquiet spirit. An argument on ghosts seemed to be impending, when Malcolm Dale burst into the room. I have never seen a man looking so utterly terrified. He sank into a chair, asked for a drink, and gulped down the brandy I handed to him. It was some time before he could speak coherently, but at last he managed to blurt out his story. It appeared that the mention of the chapel had fired his curiosity, and that when the dancing was well on the go, he had taken the key from the vase and had gone out to investigate. He took an electric flashlight with him, but had some difficulty in unlocking the door. The keyhole, he declared, was filled with rubbish, and he had had to scrape it clean with his pocket knife. At last he got the key in, and then it wouldn't turn. So he went over to the garage and got a spanner. With this he managed to twist the key in the lock. The rest of the story shall be told in his own words. When I got into the place, I noticed at once how intensely cold it was, even colder than most old churches. My light was just enough for me to see that there were no seats in the building, precious little Elsa. I had almost decided to go out again when I noticed a sort of table tomb near the east end, and so went up to examine it. Suddenly, without any warning, it seemed to crack, and out of it sprang the figure of a man with a deadly white face. Long, sharp teeth. He glared at me for a moment, and I saw the beam of my light reflect redly in his eyes. Then I turned tail and fled, but all the way back, I felt that he was after me. His voice rose to a scream as he came to the end of his tail, and I could see that he was all in. Then you left the chapel door open? Asked the vicar. Dale nodded dumbly, as if he dared not trust himself to speak. God frustrate him, the parson murmured, and then, springing to his feet, he said to me, Come, there is not a moment to be lost. We must go over and lock the door. I seized the torch which Dale still held, and within a few minutes we had reached the chapel. It looked quiet and desolate enough, but the vicar insisted on entering and seeing the tomb. It was quite an ordinary table tomb of white marble, but the top of it was cracked right across, and it was easy to see that the crack was newly made. The parson crossed himself, and together we left the building, swung the ponderous door shut, and locked it. We did not speak as we returned to the house. We got Dale to bed without letting any other members of the party suspect that anything was wrong. He was in a blue funk, and I was nearly as bad. When the vicar suggested that I should give him a shakedown in my room and let him stay the night, I almost embraced him. Well, dancing went on until about 1:30, and by 2:00 everybody had gone to bed. The vicar, whose name, by the way, was Parker, went round the house with me, and we saw that all windows and doors were secured. Wolf, the Alsatian, we brought into the hall and left him comfortably settled in front of the fire. Then we went upstairs, and in spite of the excitement, I for one was soon asleep. It must have been about 3:00 when I was suddenly awakened by the howling of the dog. Parker was already astir. Did you hear that? He whispered. Again it came, not an ordinary howl, but a howl of sheer terror. It was a sound that seemed to freeze the blood in my veins and made my hair literally stand on end. Then came a shriek of horrible laughter that was even more nerve-wracking. "Come along," said Parker. "We must see what is wrong." And he made for the door. I slipped into a dressing gown and followed him, although I must confess, I would have preferred to have stayed in my room with the door locked. The landing was dark, except for the pale light of the moon filtering through the leaded windows, and the electric light switch was at the head of the stairs. Before we could reach it, Parker suddenly gripped my arm and whispered, "Look, just beyond that suit of armor." I looked to the spot he indicated. At first, only a shadow was visible, and then, gradually, peering out of the darkness, I made out a white, grinning face. The features of the first Lord Sultan. Even as I looked, the figure moved and glided away down the staircase. I was badly shaken, but Parker, who seemed to possess nerves of steel, bounded over to the switch and flooded the staircase with light. There was nothing to be seen, but in a wave, a deadly, sickening smell came up the stairs to us. It was the fetid odor of corruption, a nauseating, vile stink that made me feel ill. Parker led the way down the staircase and at once turned all the lights on in the hall. I noticed that his lips were moving in prayer, and beads of perspiration stood on his brow. The place was empty, and it was some minutes before we saw the dog. Poor Wolf was lying near the door, and he was quite dead. Somehow the body seemed shrunken, although when we examined it, the only marks we could find were two tiny wounds in the throat. "Doesn't he look to you as if he has shrunk?" I asked Parker. "Yes," he replied. "Every drop of blood has been drained from his body." At that moment, a voice came from the top of the stairs.
"Is anything wrong, sir?"
It was the butler, and he was shaking with fright.
"Come down, man,"
I called, and then turned back to the dog. "We're up against," began Parker, and then he was interrupted by a terrified scream. We jumped up at once, and there was the butler, gibbering like a maniac at the foot of the stairs.
"Be quiet," hissed Parker, crossing the hall.
"Look,"
wailed the man. His quivering finger pointed towards the picture of the first Lord Sultan. But there was no picture in the frame. The canvas was black. It is difficult to write of those 3 hours before daybreak. We sat together in the library and prayed for the dawn. It found us wild-eyed and white-faced. When it was quite light, Parker said, "I must see that picture again." We followed him out into the hall, and there was the portrait of William Lord Sultan, leering at us from its frame. It was only a painting. We touched it to see, but the eyes glowed with a hellish fire, and the cruel lips seemed twisted in a triumphant smile. Back in the library, we sat down to discuss our plan of action. The butler, his name was Clark, took things quite well, and Parker included him in the discussion. "It all seems too terrible to be true," I said. "What can we do?" "Well," replied Parker, "I am going to make a suggestion. I have a friend, a Benedictine monk at Fairley Abbey. He happens to be an expert on occult matters, and has often been brought up against queer things. I wonder if you would allow me to invite him over. Naturally, I agreed at once. Parker telephoned to the Abbey, which was only about 5 miles from Britain. He gave no particulars over the line, but I heard him assuring the priest that it was something of vital and terrible importance.
Good, he said as he laid down the receiver. Father Vincent will be over about 10 o'clock.
After that, we went upstairs to dress and freshen ourselves up. Clark saw to the removal of the body of the dog before any of the guests came down, and breakfast was almost a jolly meal. Most of the visitors left soon after 9, but Dale and Morton were staying on until the weekend. Punctually at 10 o'clock, Father Vincent was announced and joined the vicar and myself in the library. He was a quiet little man with twinkling brown eyes, shining behind thick spectacles. Anyone less like a ghost hunter, it would be difficult to imagine. Parker told him all that had happened since Dale had unlocked the chapel, and Clark was called in to confirm the part about the portrait. The monk asked a few questions, and then he said, I may as well tell you that you are up against a most hellish thing. A man who should have died over 300 years ago, and yet by devilish arts has kept his evil mind alive. Within the tomb. He went on to suggest that Joan, Dale and Morton be taken into our confidence, and asked to help if necessary. I was a little doubtful about frightening Joan, but Father Vincent soon convinced me that it would be unwise to leave her in ignorance, so we asked the three of them to come down to the library. Dale, with his experience of the previous night fresh in his mind, was easily convinced. Morton and Joan were frankly incredulous, but I could see our seriousness impressed them. It was finally decided that the Benedictine should return to his abbey for some things he required, and then stay the night with us. If it is what I suspect, I shall have to ask you to get in touch with Lord Sultan, he said. But we can leave that until tomorrow. A wonderful man, remarked Parker when the monk had gone. These Roman priests are the only chaps who understand anything about occult phenomena. I take off my hat to them when it comes to a real tussle with the devil. Lunch was a quiet meal, and afterwards Morton and Joan played tennis. Dale, Parker and I went over to the chapel. The key turned quite easily in the lock, and the interior did not look at all sinister in the bright light of the afternoon sun. It was quite an interesting little building, dating, I should say, mostly from the middle 15th century. Some fragments of good stained glass remained in the windows. There was a stone altar, a few benches, and the marble table, too. Whilst we were looking around, Father Vincent joined us. I have just arrived, he exclaimed, and they told me you were here, so I thought I would stroll down and look over the place. We showed him the crack in the tomb, and he agreed that it was certainly new. He also pointed out a number of dark stains on the flat top of the monument, and it was not long before he discovered similar stains on the stone slab of the altar. What do you make of them? Asked Parker. They look to me like bloodstains, answered the priest. It is a horrible thought, but if they are... Something has been killed on this altar. You notice how the stain runs down the side, just as if the blood of a victim has dropped from the slab to the floor. Clark met us as we were returning to the house with the news that one of the parlourmaids had been found in the hall in a dead faint. On recovering, she had declared that she was going upstairs when a man dressed in black with a deathly white face, had pounced out at her. We interviewed the girl, and she not only stuck to her story, but also avowed that she could still feel the grip of his cold fingers on her wrist. At dinner, we were a very dull company, in spite of the little priest's efforts to keep us amused. Afterwards, we all went along to the library, and Joan, Parker, Morton, and Dale made up a four for bridge, whilst Father Vincent and I settled down to talk and smoke. I never knew that a monk could be such good company. He seemed to have travelled all over the world, and had a fund of excellent stories about all manner of places and all sorts of people. The time passed pleasantly enough until about 11 o'clock, when Clark came in with the whisky. I remember that he was just squirting the soda into Parker's drink when, eerie and shrill, a burst of wicked laughter echoed through the house. For a moment or so, none moved. And then the priest sprang to his feet and rushed out into the hall. We were not slow to follow him. Instinctively, our first glance was towards the portrait of William Sultan. Only a blank canvas filled the frame. The figure had gone. "I don't think the servants will come to any harm," said the priest later on. "He will hardly go into the new wing of the house." We had sent Joan off to bed, and Father Vincent had carefully fastened a crucifix to the door of her room and sprinkled the threshold with holy water. The rest of us, including Clark the butler, had agreed to keep watch in the hall. The monk had made us sit in a semicircle round the fire. All around he had sprinkled his holy water, and on the mantelpiece he had lighted 2 blessed candles. He himself took up a position near the fireplace. "It is as well for you to know what you are up against," he went on. "This William Sultan, however melodramatic it may sound, undoubtedly sold his soul to the devil. Unholy sacrifices were offered by him in the chapel. And after death, there was no rest for him in the grave. He became what we call a vampire. Evidently the portrait is connected with him in some very intimate way, and he can, by some fell means, animate the painted figure for his own ends. Around you I have sprinkled holy water, blessed with the rites of Holy Church, and I want no one to pass beyond the circle until the portrait is back in its frame." "You think it will return, then?" asked Morton. "It must return," was the reply. "You," the monk went on, turning to me, "must watch the frame very carefully, and let us know if you see anything out of the ordinary. I want Mr. Parker to keep an eye on the staircase, Mr. Dale to watch the door, and Mr. Morton to keep the passage to the kitchens under observation." We sat there, smoking in silence. The priest had his breviary and was reading his office, and Parker idly turned the pages of a magazine. Then, without any warning, the place seemed to go very cold, and again came that rotten odour of decay. Father Vincent motioned us to remain still, and I could see that his lips were moving rapidly in prayer. Suddenly the candle flames flickered and changed to a peculiar shade of blue. It was getting too much for us. Our nerves were all keyed up to breaking pitch, and I was not surprised to hear Dale move his chair and notice him throw his head back in a queer way he had. What followed is too horrible to think about. There came a sickening, sucking sound. Poor Dale screamed, and I had a vague vision of 2 fang-like teeth at his throat. It was all over in a moment. We jumped up, and as we did so, there came that peal of wicked laughter again. We looked towards the picture. The figure was there once more. Dale was unconscious, and the others carried him up to his room whilst I telephoned for the doctor. "Better not say too much to the medico," said Parker. "He wouldn't understand." "I wonder exactly what did happen," remarked Morton. "I think poor Dale pushed his chair back and got his head beyond the circle of holy water," answered Father Vincent. We waited up in Dale's room for the doctor to come, and as soon as we heard the sound of his car in the drive, Clark went to let him in. He was a fussy little man who cleared us all out of the room whilst he made his examination. He was soon out again. His brows crinkled in a puzzled frown, and he inquired at once how it had happened. "We were sitting in the hall," I replied, "and he suddenly went off. Just a gasp, and then he was unconscious. Just so," he went on. "Weak heart. Seems to me that the trouble is long-standing. Has he been in the tropics at all?" "He is an explorer," I answered, "and has been in all parts of the world. In fact, he has only just come back from the East." "That accounts for it. So many of these people get heart trouble and never bother about it. One thing puzzles me. That is two tiny, festering punctures in the throat. Looks as if he may have scraped a couple of pimples while shaving." We made no comment, but I saw Parker start forward as if to say something and then think better of it. "Don't worry about him. He will be all right as soon as he recovers consciousness," the doctor assured us. But he was wrong. Poor Dale never recovered consciousness. By 8 o'clock, he was dead. Father Vincent put a telephone call through to Lord Salton and was fortunate enough to find him at home. He promised to leave London at once, and true to his word, he was at Abbot's Grange soon after lunch. He turned out to be quite a young man and greeted both Parker and Father Vincent as old friends. We gathered in the library, and Father Vincent gave him the facts of the case. I could see that the boy was very much upset, particularly when we had to tell him of the death of Dale. "I will most willingly tell you all I know," he said. "William Salton has always been the skeleton in our cupboard." Each heir to the title at his coming of age is told the story of the First Lord, and warned never to leave the chapel door open between dusk and sunrise. I have never taken the matter very seriously, and I am afraid I ought not to have left the key with the agent. As you already know, my ancestor was once a Cistercian monk, but he was turned out of the monastery for practicing witchcraft and the black art. Really, he was a greater villain than even the monks suspected. At the dissolution, he gave evidence against the abbot and brethren of Ritten, and for his services was made Lord Salton and given this house. Under his rule, Abbot's Grange became Temple of Satan. He is said to have celebrated the Black Mass in the chapel, and to have sacrificed living children on the altar. The picture in the hall is a self-portrait, and tradition says that canvas is really the skin of one of his victims, coated over with human blood. Even after his death, he terrorized the district. For over half a century, there were tales of children stolen from their cradles in the dead of night by a man with a strangely white face. Then in 1630, the Lord Salton of the time went into the chapel and found the altar dripping with fresh blood. He called in a parson named John Rogers, who carried out some religious ceremony there, and since then the chapel has not been opened after sunset until this week. With a word of apology, he got up and went over to one of the oak bookcases. Sliding a concealed panel at the end, he took out from the cavity behind 2 small vellum-bound books. Laying these on the table, he went on. "These books are diaries kept by William Salton. I have never read them through. I know of 2 passages which may interest you." He opened one of the books and read from it. "At last I have completed the portrait in the manner laid down by the master Sepharius. Now, even if my body decays, I have that which will give me the semblance of life. The other note," he continued, "was made in the 2nd volume by John Rogers. Ah, here it is. Terrible is the power of the evil one. He that is dead yet wanders abroad seeking whom he may devour. I have watched and prayed, and it seems that he may only be free of the grave for 3 days at a time. Then for 3 days he must rest within the tomb. I have sealed him there, but should he ever break free again, let it be remembered that on the 3rd day he will return to the grave. That will be tomorrow, interpolated Father Vincent. God grant that nothing happens tonight. You must see that it doesn't, answered Sultan. If I am able to keep him within the picture for tonight, have I your permission to do whatever I think fit in the morning? Asked the priest. You can do whatever you like, was the reply. I am only too anxious that such a heritage of evil shall not be handed on to my successors. Sultan asked if I could put him up for the night, and we were all very glad to have him to stay. With Dale dead upstairs, and the horror of the unknown hanging over us, we were not a very lively party. The priest made his preparations early in the evening. A semicircle of salt was made around the picture. This was sprinkled with holy water, and in the centre he placed a crucifix. Just before midnight, we began our watch. We hadn't long to wait. About 20 minutes past the hour, the figure in the frame began to move. It jumped to life with curious, jerky, mechanical movements. Then it tried to step down, but was evidently prevented by the arrangements the monk had made. A look of diabolical hate passed over its features. And then it laughed. As the laughter died, it began to intone a kind of weird chant. I could not understand the words, but I knew it for some incantation to the devil. Suddenly, Morton screamed and pointed to the stairs. We all looked up, and there, moving slowly down, was the figure of Malcolm Dale, the man whose dead body lay upstairs. Morton screamed again, and then fainted. I saw the monk step forward with crucifix in one hand, and breviary in the other. In a clear voice, he began to read the office of exorcism. And all the time, that terrible incantation went on. Louder and louder rose the infernal chant, and clearer rang the voice of the priest. It seemed that the forces of good were waging a battle with the powers of evil. The perspiration ran in great drops down the monk's face, and I found myself praying the words of the Our Father, the only prayer I knew. Gradually, the hellish chant got quieter, whilst Father Vincent's voice grew stronger in volume. Then a strange thing happened. A beautiful smile came over the face of the thing that looked like Malcolm Dale, and, still smiling, it slowly faded away. From the picture came a most unearthly shriek, and for a few moments the figure in the frame seemed to writhe in agony. Then it became still. It was only a painting once again. We may have won the 1st round of the fight, my friends, said the little priest. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon of the following day. If John Rogers' calculations are correct, said Father Vincent, the monster should be back in his grave by now. The monster should be back in his grave by now. Armed with crowbars, we were making our way to the chapel. The priest carried a small Spanish dagger with a cross handle. Sultan unlocked the door, and we went inside. The place was rather gloomy, for it was a dull day. Nothing seemed to have been disturbed. Now we come to the worst part of this horrible business, said the priest. Taking a crowbar from Morton, he went up to the tomb and inserted the implement under the slab. I put mine under the other side, and together we levered until the top swung up. It was an easy matter to lift it off. Inside was a brass-bound coffin, and all over it were dark brown stains. We lifted the coffin out of the tomb and laid it before the altar. "If any of you feel at all nervous, you may go outside," said Father Vincent. Morton took him on his word, but Salton, Parker, and I stayed on. It did not take long to remove the lid, and inside was no crumbling skeleton, but the body of William Lord Salton, looking just as he must have looked in life. His eyes gleamed at us with a malevolent stare. His lips were unnaturally red, and his white, fang-like teeth protruded over his bottom lip. "Stand back!" cried the monk. He raised his dagger aloft, and then, praying in Latin, brought it down into the creature's heart. The red mouth opened in a piercing shriek. The body writhed as if in agony, and then it slowly crumbled to dust before our eyes. We sealed the coffin and placed it back in the tomb. The slab was returned to its position, and Sultan promised to see that it was cemented down. One more task remained. We took down the portrait of William Sultan, carried it into the grounds, soaked it in petrol, and set fire to it. As the flames licked that white face, it seemed to leer at us again, and I fancied the lips parted in a snarl. Sultan was very good about the lease, for, naturally, neither Joan nor I felt that we could remain on at Abbott's Grange after what had happened. I took her away to the south of France, where the sunshine and gaiety helped her to forget the nightmare of that tragic week. But I saw Malcolm Dale die, the picture come to life, Dale's ghost walk at the bidding of the monster, and the corpse of William Sultan living after over 300 years in the tomb. It will be many years before I can forget the horror of Abbott's Grange. Today's story was The Horror of Abbott's Grange by Frederick Cowles. It was read by Jasper Lestrange. Well, I hope you enjoyed it, and until next time, sweet dreams.